This is Sean Kirker with Voices Live On, and we're sitting here with Paul Cowley.
Cowley.
I keep saying Cowley. Cowley.
Lieutenant Cowley is the one they prosecuted for the My Lai massacre.
Okay. Cowley.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. So you already alluded to the fact of how you decided to go into the military, and you essentially said, I'm going in, and you called to be drafted.
That is correct.
And what was the war that was going on at that second?
That was Vietnam.
That was Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you left and you went to basic, where did you go to basic training?
I went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
And how long were you in Fort Jackson?
When I arrived in Fort Jackson, and I'm sure you've seen movies where the new guys, the new recruits are coming in, and they're getting off the buses, and they have little footprints painted on the pavement, and there's a bunch of drill sergeants running up and down screaming at you. Well, my unfortunate problem was is I was the tallest guy on my bus. And my drill sergeant was approximately 5'1", maybe 112 pounds, and it was all muscle, and he was a good Alabama Southern boy. And because I was the tallest guy that got off the bus, he immediately was in my face. Because you get the big guy in line, everybody else will follow. So we started my basic training, and we were about week four into an eight-week training class. And I got sick, and I went on sick call, and they put me in the hospital for 48 hours with an upper respiratory infection. The day that I got out of the hospital was the day we were to go through the gas chamber. So I said to my drill sergeant, I said, "Drill sergeant, I just got out of the hospital for an upper respiratory infection. I don't think I should go in there," which... what you're required to do is you go in there. They have a 55-gallon drum in the middle of the room. You are wearing your gas mask. They take a tear gas, throw it into the drum, and then you have to walk around the circle with your gas mask on. Don't run, just walk very patiently, calmly. And then they yell, "Remove your mask." You take your mask off. Once again, do not run. And then you continue to go around this barrel, and you have to recite your name and your service number, and then you very calmly walk out of the building. Well, because I told him I shouldn't be in there, three times around the barrel for me. Next morning, I'm back on sick call. I'm back in the hospital, this time for a week. And so when I got out, that's when my company sergeant informed me that I had missed too much training to graduate from my basic training, and I was going to have to wait a week for another class to start. So I had to start basic training all over again. The good news was, is since I was that far along when they moved me up Tank Hill to another company that was starting their basic, they made me a squad leader because, you know, I'd already done some of that. And I got a few special privileges being a squad leader. And the fact that I'm telling you, I remember maybe 10 days into physical training. Oh, they're intense. And every meal, you have to go down the bars the first few days. You go down the bars, you go eat your meal, and that's breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Then, after about 5 days of that, you go down the bars and back. And then it progresses down the bars, back, and down the bars again. And then you get to where you're going up and down the bars about 5 to 6 times. And I remember laying in my bunk with my arms across my chest because I hurt so bad and tears just coming down. And, you know, I hurt so bad. But now all these newbies, they're the ones crying. And I've done, hell, I go up and down them bars 10 times. But so after... well, and now here, you know, I got to throw this in there. After about 6-7 weeks, you can get a weekend pass. So me and three other guys rented a car. Now, I'm making about $127 a month. And the four of us rented a car, and over Friday night, we drove to Myrtle Beach. I'm 20 years old. I've never seen the ocean. I'm fair complected. When we got to there, we took blankets with us. We go out on the beach, and we're going to sleep on the beach. We wasn't there 20 minutes, and here come the police telling us, no, you do not sleep on the beach at Myrtle Beach, because hotels don't like that. So we ended up paying a guy $10 to let us park the car at a gas station, and the four of us slept in a Chevy Nova. So the next morning, I hit this little shop, and I bought me a pair of flip-flops, swimming trunks, and a muscle shirt, and I hit the beach. That night, about 9 o'clock, as I'm laying in the back seat with my testicles up inside my body, I'm curled up in the fetal position, and I'm just puking up clear liquor. They drove me back to the base, took me to the hospital. They admitted me for second-degree burns over 70% of my body. So on Monday morning, I hear my company commander out in the hall screaming, "Where's Private Cawley?" "He's back there, sir." He comes back to my bunk, and he gets in my face, and he's telling me, "Soldier, you will get up, you will put on your uniform, and you will report for duty, or I will court-martial you for defacing government property." Wow. So... and I mean, I have got huge blisters all over me. And so he let me that day have barracks guard, took it easy on me. But the next day, we were training for hand-to-hand combat. Now, putting on my boots with those blisters on top of my feet, and then when, you know, they flip you and you bust all them blisters on your back. I mean, oh, God, it just can't get no worse than this. But I found out Nam it can. So anyway, I got through, I graduated, and now I have a weekend pass before I start my AIT, which is Advanced Individual Training, which I was sent to infantry school. I'm going to be a rifleman. So my first wife, Susan, got on a bus and came from Indianapolis to Columbia, South Carolina, and we locked ourselves in a motel room and like rabbits for the whole weekend. And she had conveniently quit taking her birth control pills. So, my second son was born when I was in the jungles of Vietnam.
Well, what's his name?
Jeffrey Cawley. Well, Jeffrey Joshua Cawley. So, anyway, I went through my AIT, and we had about 380 of us in that class. 379 of us got orders for Vietnam, and the one guy that didn't, his name was Tim Hogan, he lives in Fort Wayne, Indiana, he got orders to go to Germany. Why? Because he was a sole surviving son, and they can't put him in combat. So, I got about a 27-day leave, and then I flew from Indianapolis to Seattle, Washington. In Seattle, Washington, in November, it's cold and it's snowing. Well, they had took away our other clothing and issued us jungle fatigues. So for 5 days, I run around in Seattle, Washington in jungle fatigues, waiting for my plane to take me to Vietnam. We loaded on the plane for Vietnam. It's a 24-hour flight from there to Vietnam. You fly from there to Anchorage, Alaska. you get off the plane for 1 hour while they refuel it, then you fly to Japan, you get off the plane for 1 hour while they refuel it, and then you land in Cameron Bay, Vietnam, and it's about midnight. They open the door, and it's about 95 degrees. By 6 o'clock the next morning, for roll call formation, I couldn't get out of bed. So they sent a litter over to get me. They took me to the hospital. I had a fever of 103, and like I said, I could not sit up. I got this butter bar lieutenant doctor that thought that I had spinal meningitis, so he did a spinal tap on me. That is what they created so that a man can know what a woman goes through during childbirth. Of course, it came back clear, and so then he reasoned that, well, you must just have a severe upper respiratory infection. So I'm in the hospital for about 5 days there. By the time I got out, all the guys that I had trained with and shipped over with were gone. They had already been assigned their units. So I never saw anybody that I trained with again, you know. And so then they assigned me to the 101st Airborne, which was in I Corps. Vietnam was divided into four sections, starting at the northern section was I Corps, 2nd Corps, 3rd Corps, 4th Corps. And when I got up to I Corps, it's monsoons. And monsoons, it rains day and night, 24 hours a day, for 3 months constantly. It just don't stop. And within 24 hours, I'm back in the hospital again, this time only for 2 days. And my body just couldn't take those quick climate changes. You know, it just said, no, you can't do this to me. So they actually made me talk to a shrink because they thought I might be sandbagging, you know, not wanting to go to war. And I told the shrink, you know, when he was talking to me, I said, you know, I can imagine there are guys that sandbag, you know, but how do you sandbag when you got a fever of 103? You know, I mean, isn't that really sick? And so, yeah, you got a point. So then I went through a week of what they called CERTS training, Screaming Eagle Replacement Training. And even though all the training we'd gotten stateside, now they bring you up to speed on how our typical operations are in our region, the kind of booby traps that we're running into, and how the enemy typically operates, and you know, just bring you up to speed. So then I actually got assigned to my battalion, company, and platoon. And so the helicopters go out to the platoons and the company in the field about every 4 to 5 days to resupply them. And then if there's people in the field that for some reason have to come back to the rear, they bring them back. And then if there's newbies like me that need to go to the field, they take us out. So I'm about 2 days away from going out into the field and joining my platoon. And dumbass me, I'm hanging around in this hooch. Never hang around, you know, not doing nothing. Door swings open. There's a sergeant there, said, "Who are you?" "Private Colley." He said, "You have a weapon?" "No, sergeant." He said, "Go to the armory, get one, and report to headquarters." "Yes, sergeant." So I went to the armory. I got me a weapon, give me two bandoliers of magazines, and a web belt, and he gave me a couple of frags. And so I go over to headquarters, and they have got about 12 of us over there. And the sergeant says, "Okay, here's what's going on, guys. We've got intel that VC is coming into the village down the road at night and getting resupplied. So what we're going to do is we're going to go down there, we're going to set up an ambush, and we're going to get them." So they put us on the back of a deuce and a half. We go about 8 miles down the road to this village. We walk through the village, and just as we're going outside of the village, and that's where the rice paddies are, and they got berms, you know, and we're now, oh, yeah, when we got off the truck, the sergeant said to me, "Who wants to walk point?" And nobody's looking, you know. And he said, "Well, somebody's got to walk point." And they said, "New guy." So he said, "Have you ever walked point?" I said, "Sarge, I just got here, you know." He said, "Well, here's what you're going to do. You're going to be the front man." And he said, "Your job is to look at the ground." He said, "If you see anything that don't grow there, you stop. I will be right behind you, slack. And if I see you looking ahead, I will hit you in the back of your head with the butt of my rifle. Do you understand me, soldier?" "Yes, sergeant." "Let's go." So once we got through the village, and now we're out there, rice paddies, and we're walking the berm, and I'm every step I take, I'm staring. And every now and then I would look a little bit so I know where I am going to go. And all of a sudden, I'd never heard it, but I knew what it was the second it happened. I saw the ground just doot, jumping up in front of me, and I knew that's an AK-47. It's got a very distinct sound, like no other weapon. And so I see the bullets are hitting the ground, and it's coming toward me. And so I just dove into the rice paddy, and so did everybody else. And in Vietnam, they bury their dead setting up, and then they mound the dirt over them. And the village chiefs and the elders and stuff, for respect, their graves always have little walls around them. And so there were VC hiding behind that wall. And so the sergeant got on the radio and called in for air support. And, you know, we're just pinned down. And it was about 8 to 9 minutes, and here come a Cobra. And the sergeant said, "I'm popping smoke," threw a smoke out. You never tell the helicopter what color of smoke you're popping. The helicopter tells you what color of smoke they see, because the enemy hears the helicopter too. And so he said, I got goofy grape. That's us. About, you know, click in front of us. You know, there's gooks at the grave. And I hear him come over the radio and said, "I got him." With a minigun, it's an electronic machine gun. He said, "They're yours," and then he flies off. And so we go up, and there are three bodies that have just been riddled with bullets. Now it's too late to go on out and set up an ambush. So we go back into the village, and we stopped at the very first house, and it too had a little 2.5 feet wall around his yard. And so we set up an ambush there. But the ambush has done been ambushed. But because of that, my very first mission out, I earned my combat infantryman's badge. When you get out of infantry school, you get that blue shield that's got the musket in it. And then, you are the expert infantryman. But once the crest goes around it, that means you have been in battle. There is nothing on the Army uniform ever worn higher than a CIB or a CMB, which is a combat medic's badge. Same thing, Red Cross sign. Once the crest goes around it, they've been in combat. If you ever see someone with the crest and a star in that gap, they've been in two wars. If there is in that gap, there's two stars, they've been in three wars. I have seen a few of them. They were World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. So anyway, about 2 days later, I went out and joined my platoon in the bush. And as soon as I got off the helicopter, this guy comes walking up to me and said, didn't ask me my name, "Where are you from?" I said, "Indianapolis." "Hey, Doc, we got another damn Hoosier." So he comes up and, you know, introduces himself. He said, "I'm Doc Hurley." He said, "Where are you from in Indiana?" I said, "Indianapolis." He said, "I'm from Valparaiso." So he had only been there about 2 weeks himself, so he was still an FNG. And And when you're in the bush, you got to have a poop buddy, somebody that when nature calls, goes with you and pulls guard while you take care of that. And so he became my poop buddy. And so I remember that first night in the jungle, it was just so horrifying. There's there's no beds, there's no cots, you know, there's no Holiday Inns, a Motel 6. Lay on the ground. It's raining. It's been raining for weeks. It's muddy. And you just wrap yourself up in your poncho liner and lay down on the ground. And, of course, you never really go to sleep. You rest with your eyes closed. And the one thing that I still suffer of today, and it's, my God, 47 years, is silence. When it goes quiet in the jungle, something's going to happen. Silence wakes me up. And to this day, I have to have a background noise. And, of course, when I married my second wife, you know, she thought it was bullshit, and she'd turn it off on me after I'm asleep. I'd be right up. What's going on? So, anyway, I'm laying there. It's raining on me. I feel something all over me, but it's pitch black. You can't see your hand in front of your face. And, you know, a triple canopy jungle, you know, sometimes you'd be in a spot that's clear enough, you get a little starlight or moonlight, you know. But I remember laying there thinking, I've got a year of this shit to go. I'm not going to make it. I just know I'm not going to make it. And but I made it. I made it that night, and I made it the next night. And then when you wake up in the morning, those that smoke, you light up two cigarettes. One you start smoking, the other one to get the leeches off of you. And I mean, they would be that long and big around as my thumb. And you never, never pull them off of you, because you'll tear the head off and you will get infected. So you just touch them with that cigarette and they'll let go, and then you throw them, and then you hand that cigarette to the guy that don't smoke so he can get the leeches off. And then, you know, you have breakfast, beanie weenie, spaghetti and tomato sauce, ham steak, beef steak, pork steak. They're all Spam, just different colors. It's just, sea rations. What we learned to do, now the Army, because, you know, we did it, we would ride home, send us Tabasco sauce, send us Heinz 57, send us A1, and, you know, we'd doctor it up enough, you know, hell, we could probably eat a dog turd and make it taste good. And the way we would typically patrol is, we had three squads in our company, and squad one would go out about a click, and then they would radio back. We would move up to them. Then squad two would go out about a click. We'd move up to them. Then squad three, and we would do that all day long. We're patrolling. We're looking for the enemy and hoping we don't find him. And then about somewhere around 4 to 6 o'clock, a lot depend on the season, you know, we would start looking for what we'd call an NDP, a nighttime defensive position. And basically, just like in the old West, a wagon train, you know, you get in a circle. And so then every guy in the platoon has duties, you know. Typically, there will be six guys that are carrying Claymore mines. So, you know, the platoon sergeant would, or the platoon leader would tell them, okay, go set a Claymore there, set a Claymore there, put one over here. You look at ways you think the enemy would come. And which one of the things they taught us in our search training, Claymore mine is, it's got plastic C4 inside with a million ball bearings, and it's curved radius. And it even says on it, front toward enemy, you know, this is for the idiots, you know. And they said, but what happens is VC, you know, they've been following you all day, you know, and they see you set that Claymore. And so at night they'll crawl up there, pick it up, turn it around, crawl back, and then shake a tree. click, click. So what you do is three guys go out to set up a claymore, and you make a little circle so they can't see you. And you take your hand and you scoop out a little bit of dirt. You put a frag in there. You set the claymore on top of it, and you pull the pin. Go ahead. Crawl out there. Pick it up.
What's a frag?
A hand grenade. Okay. Fragmentation grenade.
Got it.
Yeah. And so then, you know, we would have two machine guns in our platoon, and we would once again, you know, find the best avenue of approach. Every rifleman had to carry a rifle, three bandoliers, of which are seven magazines, 20 rounds for your rifle, four frag grenades, and two smoke grenades. And then you either carried a claymore or you carried 200 rounds for the machine gun. And now, like the medic, because he carried an aid bag, he didn't have to carry claymores or frags, you know, because, you know, if you hit the shit, somebody's screaming medic, you know, and which, you know, medics generally don't, you know, engage in the battle, and so you don't have to carry a weapon, but I never knew a medic that didn't carry a weapon, you know. And and then typically two times during the night you're going to be woke up to pull guard duty, and which became a habit that until, I'm going to say 4 or 5 years ago, I still had that habit. I could not sleep through a night. I would, and my kids, when they were teenagers, hated it, because I'd tell them to be home at midnight. Now, I went to bed at 10, but I'm up at doing guard duty at 1:30, and you wasn't in your bed. You know, damn, Dad. But I would wake up, and I'd have to check out my perimeter, make sure everything's okay, and then I could go back to bed. But 2.5-3 hours later, I'm up again checking my perimeter. And then I had four reoccurring nightmares. And but I, like I said, I finally went to the VA, and it took a long time. But they finally have me on medication that I can sleep through the night without the nightmares. I'm not as nasty as I used to be. I used to be just nasty. That's all I can say. A stupid person, I'd just get right in their face and tell them how goddamn stupid they are. Excuse, I know you're a, and I believe in Jesus and God too, but, you know, it's just the soldier coming out in me. And so anyway, I'm there, I'm going to, and I have the paperwork that's got the actual dates, but from memory, I'm going to say I was there about 5 or 6 weeks. And the doc had gone out with the first squad to do a patrol, and we heard a boom. Then they came over the radio, said, "Doc's hit." So, shit, I shouldn't have done this, but I did it anyway. I should have waited for the squad to move up there, but I did. I took off running, and I got there, and he was on the ground. He was bleeding. I grabbed his aid bag and I started doing what I could for him, and the rest of the platoon moved up, and so they immediately got on the radio, called for a dust off, and while we're waiting, the platoon leader asked me, he said, "Colley," he said, "you have any medical training?" "Yes, sir. When I was in the Boy Scouts, I got the first aid merit badge." He said, "You're the most qualified. You keep Doc's aid bag, give your machine rounds to somebody else, and you hump that." So for, I'm going to say it was 2 to 3 weeks. Like I said, once again, I've got the reports that have the actual dates and stuff. But anyway, Doc came back. It was mostly superficial. And so they ended up, they was referring to me as the assistant medic. And and I was in 1st Platoon. 3rd Platoon, the medic that was in that platoon, the platoon leader, they just clashed really bad to the point that he thought his medic was incompetent. So he heard that 1st Platoon had 2 medics, so he told the company commander, he said, I want one of those medics, and he said, and you can take the one I've got away, I don't care, but, you know, I don't want him to be my only medic. So the company commander told him, he said, well, that other guy's not a medic, you know, he took the place. He said, well, then make him a medic. So they sent me to the rear for 2 weeks, got some OJT training, basically 12 drugs that we used in the field, and you know, how and when to administer morphine, you know, start an IV, all that kind of stuff. And so they sent me back out to be a medic, which they were going to change my MOS from infantryman to medic, but because I'd already been awarded a combat infantryman's badge, I could not be awarded a combat medic's badge in the same war. Now, if I stuck around for another war, I could be a medic and get a CMB. So I just operated as a medic. I never had that MOS. And then about 6 months into my tour, I got a letter from my mom, and so did about 4 or 5 other guys, got letters from home saying that President Nixon had been on television and announced that he was going to withdraw the 3rd of the 506 Infantry from Vietnam and return them to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. So, of course, we all think we're going to go home. And about a week later, the helicopters came out and pulled us out of the bush and took us back to the rear. They had tents and cots set up. So we was able to take a shower. We actually had a hot meal in a mess hall, and, you know, we're doing the happy dance. We're going to go home. And the next morning, they had a battalion formation. The battalion commander come out and said, men, there's this rumor going around that you're all going home. That is not what's happening. He said, what's happening is the colors are going to go home. And if you have 30 days or less of your tour, you will go home with the colors. The rest of you, we're cutting you new orders, assigning you to a new unit to finish out your tour. So as bad as I felt, knowing I still had 6 months to go, I started laughing to myself saying, where's that poor son of a bitch that's got 31 or 32 days? So anyway, so they assigned me to another infantry battalion, the 327th. And once again, while we're waiting for a helicopter to take us out to our new platoon, at a morning formation, the company sergeant said, men, any of you new 11 Bravos that transferred in here, he said, the aviation company is looking for door gunners. They've lost in a 45-day-long battle called Lamson 719, which was an Arvin battle, Arvin being the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, the South Vietnamese Army, went up against NVA regulars just over the border into Laos. And in that and the 101st Aviation supported them during that 45-day-long battle. They lost 158 aircraft, and which, you know, they lost a lot of guys, but, you know, we had one guy in my aviation company, Gary Lee, he got shot down 3 times in 1 day. And, you know, we don't leave no one behind. You know, they would extract him, take him back. And the only reason, and Gary tells the story, it's so funny, he said, only damn reason I didn't get chopped down 4 times, they ran out of helicopters. So anyway, they said, if you can pass a flight physical, you know, you qualify to be a door gunner because you've got you know, infantry training with an M60 machine gun. So, okay, here's what I know about door gunners. They come back to the rear every night. They get paid $65 a month more, which don't seem like a lot until you consider, as an E4, drawing combat pay, flight pay, I was now making $327 a month, which is just a little over $10 a day. It was a lot of money. And they had an EM club where you could go and get a cold soda, cold beer, and once every couple of weeks they'd have a movie that they would show. Now, if you were an NCO, they could get cold beer, cold sodas, had a movie, and could get hard liquor. Now, if you were an officer, you could get cold sodas, cold beer, hard liquor, movies, and the nurses. So, anyway, I went, I took the physical, I passed, and they accepted me as a door gunner, which the things I found out in the first few hours of becoming a door gunner is, the life expectancy of a door gunner in a hot landing zone is 7 seconds. Why didn't you tell me this first? And then you really, the door gunning is incidental. You know, it's just, that's really not your main job there. Your main job is to be the eyes for the pilot on your side of the helicopter. Helicopter, they have to use both hands and both feet. It's all hydraulics, incredibly sensitive. How those guys can hover them, I to this day, I don't know. I've had, you know, a few hours of stick time. And anyway, all they can do is look straight ahead. And, you know, when they come in for a landing zone, you know, they typically flare and come down like that. You know, unless it's a tight landing zone, and then they have to hover down, which is a real hard thing to do. So they like that flare and sit down. So they depend on you to be hanging. And we had on my side, we called it the Christmas tree because we hung smoke grenades on it. And I would grab a hold of that. I would have my M60 here. And we're going in, I check out the landing zone, the approach, and I'm looking at the main rotors, looking at the tree line, checking the tail rotor, make sure we're not going to set down on a stump, a rock, or a skid go into a hole. And I tell the pilot, you're clear down right. Meanwhile, the gunner on the other side, he's doing the same thing, you're clear down left. If there's something, you know, I would tell him, you know, move left, move up, move back, you know, don't sit down, hover, you know, whatever. And then, by the way, if you get shot at, you have a machine gun, you go ahead and return fire. And which now they gave us, it was called a chicken plate that we could wear, but nobody wore it. We all sat on it because most of the bullets... So I had two incidents when I was in the jungle that I should have died, and the one I've told you about, I was walking point. Like I said, what we always laughed about is that they never taught their soldiers how to aim; they just taught them how to shoot, and they trained us to aim and then shoot. That was one time. Another time, I hit a tripwire. But it was not a mine. It was a flare that had been left by our guys. And I did something I wasn't supposed to do. When we came into this clearing, I just knew because of the clearing, the time of the day, this is going to be our NDP. I looked all the way across it, and I saw two trees that were about 10 inches around, and they were about 8 to 9 feet apart. Which, if you had a hammock and you had trees, you didn't have to sleep on the ground. You know, your ass touched the ground. You'd put that hammock in there low enough that when used in it, but you're not covered in leeches in the morning. Now, that don't work when you're in the lowlands and you're sleeping in elephant grass. You know, there are no trees. So anyway, I wanted those trees, So I broke out of formation. I didn't wait for the point squad to clear the clearing. And I cut right across that thing, and I was halfway across it, and I felt that wire right across my ankle. And I just literally, my life, and I just was waiting for the boom, and instead, pop, psh, it was a flare. It was a flare. And now, door gunning, we, at a morning at the flight ops, the crew, the door gunner and the crew chief are out on the flight line. Crew chief's job is to check the oil, you know, check the bearings, shake the rods, you know, make sure mechanically we're ready to fly, take care of any maintenance. My job as the door gunner is to get the machine guns out to the ship, get our ammo, get our smokes, get our frags. And if I get all that done and the crew chief is still working on stuff, then I help him. And then, you know, during the day, he's door gunner on that side, I'm the door gunner on this side. At the end of the day, when we come back, you know, he immediately starts doing, there's daily maintenance, like you wouldn't believe on a helicopter. My job is to clean all the weapons, get them back to the armory, you know, once again, help him if he needs it. Now, the pilots, they go into a briefing every morning, and they're told this is what our mission is today. And then the pilots, which, you know, you end up learning this, the worst most missions were 4 to 6 helicopters. The two worst positions to be in is Chalk 1 and whatever the last chalk is, be it Chalk 4, 5, or 6. Because the first one, you're going in on a combat assault, you don't know what you're going to be going into. And the last bird in and out, the NVA, you know, they can already have that landing zone, you know, marked and ready to go for mortars. And, you know, you go in, sit down, and they hit you with a mortar. And so usually when the pilots would come out in the morning, you know, we would, first thing we'd say to them, of course, is, good morning, sir. And then we would ask them, what's the mission? It's a CA, which is a combat assault. And then we would ask them, what chalk? Well, we're Chalk 1. Shit. A combat assault, and we're the first bird in. Ugh. So they come out that morning, and, you know, what's the mission? We said we're moving packs. And what that means is we're going to go pick up troops that's in a secure LZ, and then it becomes a CA. It becomes a combat assault. We're going to take them to another place and put them in. So, okay, we're moving packs. Okay, what chalk? We're Chalk 1. All right. So this platoon had spent the entire night on this ridgeline, secure LZ. And we're Chalk 1. We're coming in. We're on our final approach. And just as the pilot, I've done told him, you're clear right, you're clear left. You know, I'm hanging out there. I'm, you know, making sure. And as he flares it to set it down, we got this breeze came out of the valley, and the helicopter started rocking, and the pilot said, I can't hold it, I'm going to make a go-around. So he dropped off into that valley and swung around, and just as we got 180 degrees to that ridge line, Chalk 2 come in and sat down, and when it did, my side of the bird sat down on a landmine. And the three packs that was coming to get on the bird and the door gunner on that side, the door gunner, it just literally blew most of his face off of him. These guys, they mostly shrap metal, you know. And so all the other birds veered off this way. We did a come around. We came in and sat down, and they loaded the wounded on our bird. The door gunner, when they laid him in there, he got a hold of my left ankle and was pulling on it. And like I said, he was laying right there. and he was screaming, "Help me, help me." Calling for his mom, and there was just nothing I could do, nothing I could do. So we got back to the aid station, you know, and landed, and they came out and got him. And then that night, we found out that he died. The other guys, they all lived, but he got the butt of the blast. And then the other time, we was doing, once again, this is working with the Arvin Army. I'm sure you've heard of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Ashaw Valley, and that ran between the borders of South Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, and it's what the North Vietnamese used to move their supplies and troops and everything down. And, of course, you know, it's just a trail through the jungle. And pretty much monsoons, you know, they can almost tell you the day it's going to start. And so what the mission was is that we were going to move this battalion of Arvin Army in there at the mouth of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And they were going to hold it until monsoons set in and prevent the VC from moving a lot of supplies down south. And then once the monsoon set in, they're not going to be, you know, they can still carry some stuff, but no heavy trucks and supplies. So it was the biggest mission I ever went on. There had to have been 100 helicopters there that day. And we're sitting on this long runway on both sides of it. And we could hear them off in the distance. For about 3 hours, artillery just pounded that ridgeline with artillery. They had a couple of F-4s come in and drop shit on them. And, you know, there was no way anyone could be left alive there. And so when we were going in, we were landing five birds wide, going in flights of five. And we were chalk 25, and we were outside right. And so we're going in, and I'm doing my job. I got my machine gun in this hand, holding on my Christmas tree over here. I'm looking back, make sure the tail rotor's going to clear. And just as I come around this way, a gook stepped out from behind a tree and leveled on me with his rifle, and I just hit the button, and it just, thank you God, it was aimed right there, and I almost cut the man in two. And it was the first time I ever killed someone that I saw his face when I did it. And which, when I got back, you know, everybody was hooting and hollering and patting me on the back, and they was going to go out and paint a little gook on my gun well, and you know, it. But when you get older and you realize that he had a mother, a father, brother, sister, wife, kids, you know, it was a human life. It's hard to live with. That's one of the worst things, is survivor guilt. You know, it's like that door gunner that died in my place, and that guy, you know, it was him or me. And so I, and then when I came home, it was a horrible experience in that when I was ETS, ending time of service, I flew down to Da Nang to wait for my Freedom Bird. And what we would do is we'd eat breakfast, have a formation, and they'd read off a manifest. We'd eat lunch, have a formation, read off a manifest. We'd eat dinner, have a formation, read off a manifest. Well, my name, and I think I was there about 2 days before my name was read off on a manifest, and it was at the dinner manifest. So I am to report at midnight for out-country processing. Now, they wake us up at 6 in the morning. So midnight, I've done been awake, and then out-country processing was standing in a line. You got your duffel bag. You get up to this plywood table. They had a bunch of them there. And you open up your duffel bag and you dump everything on that table. And then they have MPs that's going through everything. You know, they teach you how to roll your underwear and roll your socks and all that kind of stuff. And they opened everything up. They was patting it down. They went through all of our photos to make sure we didn't have pictures of war dead. You know, they was looking for drugs, ammunition, firearms. And then they made you strip down to your civvies, lay your clothes up on the table, pat them down, then tell you to get dressed, repack your duffel bag. And then they'd taken 2x4s and made this huge cage and just had benches in there, go set in a cage. So at 8 o'clock, now I have been awake for over 26 hours. I take that back. At about 7, they did let us go to the mess hall and eat breakfast, then come back and loaded us on the buses, took us out to the our Freedom Bird. We got on the plane, 24 hours, okay, same trip back, Japan, Alaska, Fort Lewis, Washington. So the first thing you do is you process back into country, which takes a few hours. You know, and there's 320 of us on a plane. And then you have to sit and listen to all these speeches about, you know, your DD-214, you know, the VA, you know, get your travel orders. They did give you a steak dinner when you got back. Then you had to, because, you know, you're wearing fatigues over there. Now you got to have dress green, so you got to go get shoes and pants and suit, coat, and, you know, get everything issued to you. And then you get your travel orders, and then they put you on a bus and take you to the airport. I mean, my God, I think I've been awake for almost a day and a half now. And so I get to the airport, I go up to the counter, and the lady behind the counter, and you know, they only give you money to fly what they call military standby. And you know, military did have preference. If they have empty seats, military got the seats first before they go to public standby. And so I got up to the counter, and the lady, she said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Indianapolis." So she's typing, and she said, "You're just back from Vietnam?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." She handed me my boarding pass. She said, "Welcome home. You're flying first class." She said, "I lost my son in Vietnam." So I got on the plane. And I mean, the plane that the government contracted to fly us, I swear to God, they added another row of seats so that, because they're getting paid by the head. And I mean, literally, if you've ever rode coach, take 3 inches off the seat. That's what, I mean, we were just packed in there. I sat down in that seat in first class. I put the seatbelt on, and that's the last thing I remember until... Sir, you have to get off the plane now. We're in Chicago. I mean, just, man, I didn't get nothing to eat or drink, you know. But so anyway, I got off the plane. I had about an hour and 40-minute layover, and I'm sitting on a bench near my gate for the flight to Indianapolis. And this young girl, early 20s, literally hippie, flowers in the hair, crap. She walks by me, and she looks over at me and gives me kind of a dirty look. And then she stopped. She turned around and came back, and she pointed at me. And she said, "You're one of those baby killers, aren't you?" And I said, "What?" She said, "I know you are." She said, she didn't spit on me, but she spit at me. And she said, "Go back to your own kind. We don't want you here." And I just, what the hell? So when I got home, this is what I found out. March of 1971, John Kerry sat in front of the U.S. Senate and testified that Vietnam veterans were rapists, baby killers, warmongers, and doing acts of Genghis Khan. Google it. You can see him give the speech live. Then it was the summer of 71 that Jane Fonda came back from North Vietnam and said what horrible, horrible people we were for what we were doing to the nice people of North Vietnam. Early fall of 71, the National Guard killed four students at Kent State for protesting the Vietnam War. And then in September of 71, they convicted Lieutenant Calley for the My Lai Massacre. I got off the plane in November of 71. Welcome home. And so, like I said, I mean, people that had been my, well, and like I said, I didn't have really a lot of close friends, but people that had what I thought were friends in high school didn't want nothing to do with me. You know, I was 21 years old. It's 1971. I got a burr haircut. And even in civilian clothes, I mean, I might as well have a big sign on here, you know, Vietnam veteran. But I would go to a place that had a sign outside that says, "Now hiring," go in there, and they would tell me, "No, we're not hiring no more." And then this guy comes in behind me and says, "Yeah, I saw your sign out there." They'd hand him an application. And the guy that gave me my first job, he was a Korean veteran, and it was doing the pitchers in bowling alleys of league bowlers. So for about 4 or 5 years, I traveled in the winter months doing team pitchers of league bowlers and bowling alleys, and in the summer I traveled and did county fairs and state fairs with our mug joint, and I was probably on the road about 45 to 47 weeks out of the year. The few times I would stop in Indianapolis for a week or two, my wife would get pregnant and I'd have another kid, and then I'd have another kid. And so finally I said, you know, I got to stay here and make sure she takes those damn pills every morning.
How many kids?
Four. Four children. Three boys and a girl. So, I told you the story about once, you know, my hair had grew out. I'd never shared with anyone that I was a veteran. And, you know, I was able to get my jobs in my profession as a carpenter. And so I probably between 74, 75 up through November of 78 is the last time I got laid off and I started my own company. And like I said, some people pay a lot of money to go get a college education. I paid a lot of money in fines, penalties, making customers happy, you know, to get my education. The one thing I learned dealing with customers, if when you're sitting there talking to them about their remodeling project, and it's okay, I expect them to question me, my company, my integrity, my workmanship, but when they sit there and they tell you that, well, the guy that put the roof on my house screwed me, the guy that put up my garage door screwed me, the guy that you know, worked on my car screwed me, the guy that did my dry cleaning screwed me, guess what? I'm just the next guy that's going to screw him. So those are the people, I never give them a quote when I'm in their house. I'll tell them, well, I'm going to have to take this back to the office and figure it up. So I go back to the office and I figure if it's a $5,000 job, I give him a bid for $15,000. Because I know I'm going to have to do it twice to make some bitch happy, and I want the other five for the aggravation. And you know what? I usually didn't get those jobs.
All right, well, we're going to close this session out, but that was a pretty phenomenal road, and I thank you for your service, number one.
Thank you.